case number 08-7097, Catherine Gojak, appellants versus Electricity de France International North America, Inc. et al. Ms. Brown for the appellant, Ms. Hogay for appellees.
May it please the court, I've asked to reserve 1 minute in rebuttal. The district court erred in this case in granting summary judgment to the defendants and denying Catherine Gojak a trial by jury. The district court also erred in effectively denying Catherine Gojak's motion to compel by not ruling on it. The district court erred in this case in granting defendants summary judgment. It reached factual conclusions not supported by the record. It made credibility determinations not permitted at the summary judgment stage. And the court even, in one case, at least as to Catherine Gojak's retaliation claim, misconstrued one of the bases of her allegations. As to the factual conclusions that the court reached, the district court erred in concluding that EDF had a system of pay with regard to Catherine Gojak's equal pay claim, which justified wages to Catherine Gojak that were different than to Christian Nadal. The district court held at Appendix 3898, and I quote, "The disparity in pay between Gojak and Nadal was based on rank established when the two were originally hired at EDF," end quote. Well, Catherine Gojak was hired at EDF in 1980. Christian Nadal was hired in 1988. But more importantly, the R1, R2, R3 ranking system upon which EDF now relies to support its affirmative defense to Catherine Gojak's equal pay claims was not in place until 1999 or 2000. EDF's own corporate designee, Patrick de Botherall, Appendix 1083-84, testified that the R ranking system was not in place until 2000. Apelli Nadal testified that he was not given an R ranking until 2002.
Yeah, but it was a conversion from a system that was doing the same thing.
Not exactly. Patrick de Botherall testified that when they put the R ranking in place, he admitted that in part that was a subjective and objective system. And he also admitted in part that part of the R rankings were based on what the company believed was the aptitude of the individuals to be ranked. More importantly, even if...
Well, my point is that all that did was to capture what they thought was presently in place in terms of how they were ranking and paying people. So they called it R later on, they called it something else before that, but it was essentially the same thing. You don't mean to suggest that if there are subjective elements in a ranking system, that they're by definition discriminatory?
No, I'm not suggesting that at all, but I do think the circuit has held on numerous occasions that the question as to whether the subjective or objective nature of the ranking system or the affirmative defense stated by the defendants is applicable in the case is a factual question. Catherine Gojak here has proffered sufficient evidence that the R ranking system, one, although there was a prior ranking system, the R ranking system, Patrick de Botherall testified in detail that in fact they made additional credibility determinations when deciding who should receive the R 1, 2, 3 rankings. I'm sorry?
Credibility determinations?
I'm sorry. They made inquiries as to the aptitude of the individual person ranked. Credibility is improper subjective is more what I intended to say. But even so, the court in Corning Glassworks, the Supreme Court in Corning Glassworks in this circuit in Goodrich versus IBEW cautioned the court that a reliance on historical progress or a historical system itself can be used to perpetuate discrimination.
Another problem is you're assuming that the work being done later by Nadal was simply a carbon copy of the work being done before by Gojak, and that doesn't seem to be the case.
We would say that the work done by Christian Nadal and Catherine Gojak was identical for all purposes.
The evidence for that is a statement made by her without having consulted him, right, in the immigration filing.
That is, but that's the only testimonial evidence on the difference between Catherine Gojak and Christian Nadal's work. That's the only documentary evidence on the difference between the two of their works that's been ever proffered in this case. In addition, there's no evidence here that Christian Adel had done anything that Catherine Gojak had not done with respect to EDF Edfina. So their work was substantially similar, although...
But you're building the ranking not just on their time with this company. They were building the ranking on their total experience package, which is not surprising.
But I believe that raises a question of fact, i.e., that it's been admitted.
It seemed to be undisputed that their history of performance was not the same.
Well, I think that takes us back to the issue of the motion to compel. As we indicated, we had asked that the court allow us to investigate Christian Adel's background. In depositions, counsel for the plaintiff had asked specifically, had Christian Adel ever been subject to criminal proceedings? He unequivocally answered no. But if we're looking at the backgrounds of these individuals, it's highly relevant as to whether Christian Adel mismanaged or caused the branch that he was running to be subject to criminal investigations, possibly even indictments, versus Catherine Gojak. There's no dispute on the record here that she had a 24-year spotless career. She was the first woman to run a power plant in France, and she received the National Merit of Honor. So if you were looking at the two backgrounds of Christian Adel versus Catherine Gojak, I don't think there's any way in this case without... I think Catherine Gojak has proffered sufficient evidence for a reasonable jury to find that they did the same work and that any proffer as to Nadal being hypothetically more qualified than her and justifying a higher rank has to be weighed with the evidence that would be obtained from the motion to compel, which is, it is undisputed, and we've submitted as part of our motion to compel, that EDF was subject to some criminal proceedings and a preliminary Edenor, the Argentine branch, was subject to preliminary indictments and... also a preliminary attachment of its assets. So if we're looking at the historics of Catherine Gojak versus Christian Nadal. I'm sorry?
There were no convictions or with respect to him of any sort.
But there were criminal proceedings against the company, and frankly, we don't know everything that followed. Catherine Gojak discovered that on her own hard work after the summary judgment pleadings had been concluded. So all we have is the information Catherine Gojak herself was able to obtain. We never got any information from the company in discovery. And candidly, it's Edenor, which is an affiliate of EDF, who would have the information on what was the outcome of those proceedings and what was the basis, which is why we asked the court to reopen the discovery period. Moreover, it's EDF's burden to meet its affirmative defense. Would just note that the district court held that Catherine Gojak had not produced any evidence to rebut EDF's assertion as to the rankings. I would just note again that more than an assertion was required by EDF, and even though Catherine Gojak did not have to rebut an assertion, she's proffered more than sufficient evidence that the R1, R2, R3 ranking system creates a triable issue of fact. As to the credibility determinations, the district court determined that when Catherine Gojak advised EDF that she would have no choice but to file a claim, EDF viewed it as blackmail and wanted to bring her back to France away from her complaints. That's Appendix 3897. The court concluded that the decision to return Catherine Gojak to France could not reasonably be considered retaliation. This is a credibility determination that EDF...
Why is it a credibility?
It's a credibility determination that EDF's stated reason was not retaliation and was done because the company wanted to return her to France away from her complaints, and that decision could not be retaliation. That is a credibility determination, and regardless, Catherine Gojak has proffered sufficient evidence that one, Mr. Cruzet, who was an executive of EDF, told her that if she complained to EDF that her career, if she filed a claim that her career would be dead. In fact, after her 24-year
outside... There's a lot of... You just ignored a huge amount of background. It was months before that I think it's Creuset, maybe it's Lescure, had said, I want you back in France, right? I mean, the idea of her going back to France did not arise immediately after this alleged colloquy that she had. Long before.
And the rotating people in and out of these positions was commonplace. She was allowed a little bit more time than normally is the case. I mean, when you're talking about retaliation claims, the court said you do it in context. You look at it in context. This is a person who was being accommodated, not retaliated against.
And having her pay very substantially increased.
But looking at it in context, there was never discussion about Catherine Gojak coming back to France until after she had complained.
No, that's not right.
That really is not right. That's not
in
what
fact,
the record said. And the record shows that the managers, these top managers, rolled around. No one was entitled to, I mean, when you look at the record, quite frankly, it looks like She's demanding it. She said, this was about me. I don't care about them. They may have had a good reason, but this is about me. It's what I prefer to do. That's the way it comes across. They were accommodating her at every turn, and she wasn't. She was demanding more than what managers typically got.
But Mr. Cousette had already told Catherine Gojek she would be permitted to stay in Washington. In fact,
accommodation, which was not normally done. They had already talked about going back to France.
They had already made a decision that Catherine Gojek would remain in Washington based on, one, the testimony that's in the case.
Not running the operation. Someone else had now moved in, and she was sending memos over her now boss telling people, this is what he's going to do, and this is what I'm going to do. That's a strange. I mean, in context, there's nothing that looks like retaliation. This looks like a woman who had a person who had a determination that she was going to get what she wanted to get.
But even so, Catherine Gojek has testified that nobody told her. She wasn't sending notes over him saying, I think you're referring to the gas analyst issue as to the...
But he was president then.
But no one had told Catherine Gojek that Christian Nadal was going to be coming in as president. And once she learned,
I'm talking about a note that went out after it was pretty clear who was where.
After she learned that Christian Nadal was going to be president, Catherine Gojek immediately sent an apology to Christian Nadal, telling him, I apologize, I've now learned that you're idiot.
Files at home when he said bring him in?
Spends a month at home, the month of June.
I mean, whoever heard of that? Your boss tells you these are critical files to the company, and you say, I'm not bringing them in. And that's not retaliation. That's absurd.
You tell her she can stay in Washington, and she said, I don't want to have to report to
Nadal. Right.
I think what Catherine Gojek said is not, if I stay in Washington, I don't want to have to report to Nadal. In fact, originally she said when she was going to complain, she tried to come up with a solution to the issue, and one of the suggestions that she made at that time, yes, was if you remove Nadal from my chain of command, then I would be able to continue to work. But
well, you just said the same thing that Judge Henderson said. You said it more nicely, more self-servingly. Come on, this was someone who was battling them at every turn. She wanted no part of this. She was furious. And about what makes no sense, because they rotated managers in and out all the time. I mean, it's chutzpah in the greatest sense. I mean, retaliation, there's no retaliation here.
We would say, Your Honor, that she has at least proffered sufficient evidence for a reasonable jury to conclude in her favor on the retaliation claim.
The Burlington test to include looking at context, a trial judge can look and say, there isn't anything here. The burden's on you, not on them.
True, Your Honor. And I think she's proffered, one, with regard to her career versus the amount of time after she was exited from the company following her complaints, Mr. Cousette's statement that her career would be dead. And
what happens after that is that she gets an appointment in France at a substantially higher salary. Now, that doesn't seem so terrible for a French employee, possibly not an American either, but...
Well, in fact, the...
Driver, maybe not a driver, a car, certainly, probably a driver. Insurance, special housing allowance.
Although the benefits were less than what she received in the United States, so her overall compensation would have been less if she left. But nonetheless, Catherine Gojek testified that the position offered to her was an inferior one. There were no...
Her testimony on that is not conclusive. It's an objective test.
She said, if I remember correctly, that she understood what they were doing, why they were doing it, made sense for the company, but not for her. Right?
Only if you look at the entire record in that EDF.
Didn't she say that? She said, it makes sense for them. Not for me, though. It's not what I want.
And the only
she
reason...
She wanted to stay in the States.
Well, but EDF also had a policy that it would meet with its expatriates before it transferred them and talk to them about what position made sense for them next. So that was part of EDF's own policy, that it would have an interview with Catherine Gojek and send her to a position that
what
was helpful
do
for
when
her.
Someone says to you, look, I can't work with the guy who's in charge now. Seems to me a very non-discriminatory answer is, okay, come back to France. You'll make a lot of money there in a good position. You have declared you can't do it.
Although that would be a classic case of retaliation if somebody complained that they believed they were being discriminated against person.
Oh, I understand. You're saying she believes, but you've got to have that as a grounding. I'm saying I find that very suspect. That is the suggestion that she was being discriminated against. The record looks pretty clearly like this was someone who had an agenda and was angry.
Although
not being discriminated against, she was just angry. She wanted things her way.
Although no case has ever said that the person complaining of discrimination has to be correct, whether or not the court believes Catherine Gojek.
You're absolutely right on that, but the court also says you look at the total context.
That's true. If I may, Your Honor, just the last point on the retaliation. If I may, Your Honor, is the last point on the retaliation again. So I'd just like to note that the EDF itself admitted that it believed Catherine Gojak's discrimination complaints to be blackmail. And it's our view that every action that it took moving forward from that. And
sorry, it admitted that the complaints were blackmail? Why is that an admission? I'm a little baffled at that. It believed them to be blackmail.
It believed them to be blackmail. Mr. Leon LaRoche testified to that.
Apparently good faith belief that you're being blackmailed stifles you from moving employees to where you think they can do useful work for you?
I wouldn't say that at all, Your Honor. But if you view a person engaging in protected activity or complaining of discrimination as blackmail, then when you respond, you may in fact punish the person, which is what happened here. And that's why the admission of blackmail is so telling in this case. Any reasonable juror who hears that a company perceived a complaint of discrimination as blackmail can conclude that the company responded on that belief that it was blackmail rather than a good faith, rather than a claim of discrimination. In addition, there's no testimony. Well, if someone complains of discrimination and the response is we find your complaint to be blackmail, we think you're just...
On the basis of the avalanche of things that justify our moving you back to France and not putting you on a par with Nadal, right?
Well, no. Catherine Gojak's original complaint of discrimination on July 9 just said, I believe that I'm being treated in a manner that's discriminatory as opposed to Mr. Zhou, who was the male vice president. That was her first complaint of discrimination. That sets the avalanche of what happened. Catherine Gojak never intended to blackmail EDF at all. She complained of discrimination. She made suggestions about ways that the parties could continue to work together. But that doesn't equal that doesn't equal blackmail. And a company who admits that we viewed a complaint of discrimination as blackmail is going to respond unequivocally in a way that is intended to punish the employee, which is exactly what happened to Catherine Gojak in this case. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Laura Hoge. My partner, Dorsey Regal, and I have represented EDF and its affiliate at FINA in this case. Morgan Hodgson from Steptoe here, Steptoe and Johnson, has represented Mr. Nadal. For the argument today, I will appear for all of the appellees. This case was argued about a year ago, a little over a year ago, shortly after the decision in Brady versus Sergeant at Arms. And that case framed the issues very neatly, very simply, for the district court, and it followed the roadmap. The question that was dispositive is whether the plaintiff offered evidence from which a jury could find that the defendant's articulated reasons for their actions were a pretext for intentional discrimination or retaliation. Judge Kennedy treated Brady, although it's a case about discrimination, the logic of Brady as applicable to the retaliation claims, and it seems sensible to do that. His opinion did it, and I'll do it here. All of the personnel actions in this case were explained.
What about the statement made, if you file a complaint, your career here is dead?
That is the context question. You have to look at the statement, alleged statement, in the context. We're talking about Exhibit 70 now, and I have it in front of me, and I'm going to point out a couple of things about the context in response to the question, if I may. Exhibit 70 is where this statement appears. I think the joint appendix page is 2035, if I'm not mistaken. The first part of it, there are notes that the plaintiff says she took after she had a conversation with Monsieur Cruzet in Paris. She says, he said, your career is dead in EDF if you file the claim. In the same conversation, he said, I do not have time to discuss the differences of views between managers. I'm very busy restructuring the EDF company. The context was that she was talking about not getting along with Nadal, and the D word, discrimination, She had used in an earlier email, she had spoken of discrimination in my position as respect to Drew, not having the check signing privileges. The context that he apparently viewed it as a difference of views between the managers, and that's what he said. He was busy restructuring the company. Her side of the conversation, though, is the context that I think is really important here. Her side of the conversation was, I'm asking for your help now. You can help me. I want my 3 years expatriation contract. I want a mission letter. I want the mission letter, something she had asked for earlier, in which she proposed that she be given exclusive control over this nuclear project called New Start. So she wanted the 3 years expatriation contract. I want a mission letter. I want the company to change the reporting structure so that I do not have to report to Nadal on a daily basis. The context, reframing out a few more feet, was that she had wanted those things all along, and at the end of May, the company had made a decision that was a compromise. They said they didn't give her the contract and the 3 years to stay in the United States, and they wanted her back in France, actually, to work on this other project. But they said, you can stay in the United States, but if you stay, you have to report to Nadal. And she continued after that to try to get the 3 year contract, not reporting to Nadal, with exclusive control over this project, New Start. In this conversation, which I have just quoted, her side of the conversation, speaking of in which the subject of this claim apparently came up, her side of the conversation was, I want my contract. In another conversation, in the same exhibit, same notes, with Monsieur Ponasso, who was the head of the branch she worked in, he was in Buenos Aires, she said the same thing. You have my word, I won't file the claim before you or Cruzet calls back with solutions on Monday, but as for now, I'm not satisfied at all with the answer of the company. I want a 3 years expatriation contract. I want a mission letter. I want the company to change the reporting structure, and so on and so forth. And then again, a couple of days later, she writes a long letter in English to the three of them, Cruzet, Mr. LaRoche, who was the head of human resources on the executive committee, and Mr. Ponasso in Buenos Aires. She writes, to reiterate what I said on Friday, I feel the company can quickly correct my situation by taking the following actions. The company signs my 3 year expatriate contract, and it goes on and repeats the same things, although this one ends up and pay my attorney's fees. Now, I submit to you that no company, no organization, government, corporate, or anything else can tolerate that behavior from somebody who works for it. It is not protected action. It's self-protection. When somebody says, I'll file a claim unless I get a contract, a 3 year contract. Now, the expatriate contract that you can see in the record is a good deal for an employee. It's meant to compensate them for the economic difficulties of having to live in a country that's not your own and to move away from your home. In the case of Madame Gojac, she had her salary, but she also had all of these related benefits, a house in Great Falls, Virginia, and trips to France, and I forget all the other things. Naturally, she wanted to hold on to those benefits. She'd applied for a green card. She and her husband wanted to stay in the United States. So she over and over and over said to EDF, give me these things or I'll sue you. I think Judge Kennedy correctly concluded that that is not the behavior of an employee who is asserting a claim of discrimination, but it's also not behavior that a company or an organization, speaking more generally, can tolerate in an employee. They can't not bring her back because she says these things. In the record, the most helpful document, I think.
Don't you always have when someone is trying to, an employee is trying to avoid going to the EEOC, saying, I believe you haven't paid me enough. I believe I was entitled to that promotion. I believe, and they may not say, if I don't get the promotion, I'm going to file the claim, but that's what they do. They either get the promotion or they file the claim.
In this case, she wasn't making a claim, actually. The thing she was talking about, that were the problem with her relationship with Nadal didn't have anything to do with gender. They had to do with the personal relationship between the two of them. And
I agree, but the protected activity was the filing of the claim with the EEOC.
But she never actually, this is another interesting point in the record, she never actually said she was going to file an EEOC claim or a discrimination claim. She never described what kind of claim it was. She just said, talk about a claim. I think it is helpful to remember that the recipients of these communications were in France and Buenos Aires, and their sensitivity to the single word discrimination may not be equivalent to somebody's here. The reasons that EDF...
July 25th, she sent an email stating that since Christian Nadal arrived, I've been subjected to personally demeaning, discriminatory, and illegal conduct that has become intolerable for me.
That is the last letter. That is correct. She said that. The testimony, and this does get to the testimony of the defendant's witnesses were that they understood that she was complaining that she didn't like the way he treated her, but they never understood her to mean discrimination based on sex. That was not what they understood she was talking about. The reasons, if you focus on the Brady, the appellant argued that the so-called threat, the statement that Crouzet made, was an adverse employment action. For Brady's purposes, we do not need to decide that question or even argue it. For the purposes of Brady, the question is whether the reasons the defendant articulated for its actions were pretextual. There is in the record here a memorandum of a human resources manager called Betoure that was written just at the time the defendants took the decision. And the Betoure memorandum sets forth what the basis for the defendant's action was, that she and Nadal were hostile to each other, that that she wouldn't share information about New Start, that they wanted her back in France, and that her contract, the term of her agreement, her expatriate agreement, expired July 31st. So for all those reasons, they decided to bring her back. The point we're trying to say here that the appellees are arguing is that there is no evidence in this record that would justify a jury in finding that those reasons were pretextual. The single statement by Crouzet is not enough to require a jury trial of this case.
Counsel, without questioning what you said there, I want to focus on whether we do have an adverse employment action. It is an objective test. There appears to be, at least measured in euros, a substantial increase in pay when she's
correct
threatened with the assignment in France. Now, the offsetting that is the expat package, and I guess I haven't seen any effort to, as you yourself said, and as one would assume, it's to compensate for special expenses associated with being in a foreign country. So that would seem to suggest that it's a wash. Now, in reality, it may not be so, but has anyone tried to evaluate it in some sort of neutral terms?
Well, it would be hard to do because the chief components of it in economic terms are the housing allowance, and I guess somebody can take the housing allowance and do pretty well with it or not, depending on their personal choices. So it's hard to value that objectively. I do not remember the number. It is in the record, but I do not remember the number, and I'm not sure it's actually stated as a number. The other piece of it, of course, is tax equalization, and that is a complexity that I think we don't need to get to here. But the expat benefit package is connected to being an expatriate, and the expectation here was that you're only an expatriate. You only get those benefits while you're an expatriate. You can't be one forever. After 3 or 4 years or whatever it is, you have to rotate out. So she didn't have any reasonable expectation of keeping that. And indeed, she over and over, it wasn't really, I think, the important thing to her. The important thing to her was staying in the United States because she and her husband had applied for green cards. I think the facts are that in July, she didn't have her green card yet, and she was very, very anxious not to be forced to leave the United States before she got it. As it turned out, she got it in mid-August, and then she was in a position to say to the French, we don't want your job, you know. But in July, when she didn't know when she was going to get her green card, she was very anxious because she was afraid that she would be forced to leave. And I think that is not, though, that set of personal preferences, I want to stay in the United States until I get my green card, is not something within the scope that Burlington intended employers to be responsible for. Of course, both Crouzet and Rousselet were gone by early September. The record shows they were out of EDF by early September. The actual termination of her employment came about because she did not report in France on November 1st. They gave her 3 months with full benefits to settle her affairs and go back to France. By November 1st, or I can't remember the date, December 10th, but there was a date that she was supposed to come back to France. She didn't come. Their rules then required that there be a hearing to determine whether she had a justification. She came to the hearing. She refused to answer any questions, and the discipline is the term that they use took place. Then her employment was terminated. She was actually retired rather than she will get a retirement benefit based on her length of service, but it was not a choice at that point. I'm corrected. My partners handed me our moving brief, which cites the place in the record. The housing allowance was rent for a residence, and I think that is what the record shows.
It's elastic.
But I think it may be. I don't know. The JA reference is 1238. There is Exhibit 15 is the contract between her and between Madame Gojac and EDF about the terms on which she would come to the United States, and if there's a number on the rent, housing rent, it's in that exhibit. I don't happen to remember the number now. If she had reported for work, there's no reason to think that she wouldn't have had a perfectly fine career. The irony of this whole thing is that Monsieur Lescure, the head of the energy branch in Paris, really wanted her for this European pressurized reactors position. They put a lot of effort into getting her to come, and I think there was no doubt that she could have done that. Thank you.
Your career will be dead if you file a claim comment is similar to the comment that was made in Desmond versus Mukasey, which was a case decided by this circuit. As you may recall, in Desmond, Mr. Desmond was applying to be an FBI agent, and during the time that he was undergoing his training, he was held up at gunpoint and robbed, and he had suffered some post-traumatic stress disorder. There were some altercations with his supervisor. Eventually, he filed an EEOC complaint. During the investigation of that complaint, the investigator, Mr. Higginbottom, told him, if you hadn't filed the complaint, I might have allowed you to graduate from the FBI Academy. And there, this circuit held that that was the type of comment that created a factual dispute that allows a retaliation claim to proceed to a jury.
Now we know right from the get-go that that case is completely different on its facts. Right?
But the comment is similar.
The comments are similar in an entirely different context. That's the whole point of Burlington. Burlington says, let's assume a verbal statement is an action as required by Burlington. So the test would still be whether the verbal threat here, what you're calling it, a verbal threat, is an action that would likely dissuade a reasonable person in her shoes, from making or supporting a charge of discrimination. And I think what the trial judge says, when I read this whole record, there's no conceivable way that I can conclude in context, which is what Burlington says, in context, that a reasonable person in this person's shoes would have perceived that comment as a threat. When you look what preceded it and what followed it, and she was being accommodated at every turn, she couldn't possibly reason, we would not assume that a reasonable person in her setting would see that as a threat. But that's the test, right?
But looking at it in context, the comment was made, she had been promised she could stay in the United States. Initially, the decision to allow her to stay in the United States was revoked. In addition, the comment was, if you file a complaint, your career at EDF will be dead. And after 24 years, that's exactly what happened.
No, that is not what happened. That's the context that I'm talking about. That's absolutely not what happened, because she didn't file anything. She didn't. I can't say this because I'm not God, but I'm betting she wasn't the least bit intimidated. They went on with the back and forth, and she continued to give them fits. She wasn't feeling the least bit threatened. She got fired only when she said, I'm not coming to your meeting, and I'm not talking to you, and I'm not going to work. Well, it would be an inane employer that didn't let her go in those circumstances. That's why she got fired. She was totally accommodated after that statement. Totally.
Well, the question, I think what Your Honor is saying, if I'm not incorrect, is that she never filed a complaint?
No, I'm saying that she didn't file a complaint. That is one among things, but that is surely not a winner under Burlington. So you don't have to tell me that because I understand that. But if I look at everything that happened after that statement was made, there's absolutely nothing to credit the suggestion that a reasonable person would have read it or seen it or believed it to be a threat, a retaliatory threat, because their interactions just in no way suggested that. They continued to interact. She continued to push forward, and she was given every accommodation and very good offers.
Catherine Gojek did file a claim with the EEOC on July 30th.
Yeah, eventually she did, yes.
But even before then, Broderick versus Donaldson tells us that there are no magic words to engage in a protected activity, so whether she actually filed the EEOC complaint,
that doesn't respond at all to context.
But nonetheless, Catherine Gojek.
Endless accommodation.
Well,
infinite accommodation, to be sure.
Which is very different from the FBI case. Very different. There was no one that took him after that meeting and said, no, wait, let's make this all. But here's what we're going to do for you. It's an entirely different case.
Your Honor, we would say, one, if you look at the context, obviously, if you look at the context of this case, Catherine Gojek continued to report to her supervisors. They were continuing to work with her. She was continuing to work with them. Nonetheless, if you look at the context and the items that occurred after Catherine Gojek complained, it becomes clear that they were acts of retaliation against her, particularly when you look at the timing of those items. And again, Catherine Gojek, under French law and under EDF's guidelines, had a right to stay in the United States once they allowed her to stay in the United States once she'd reached the agreement with Cruzet. In fact, that's why they had the justification hearing on December the 10th. The question was she justified in refusing the position that had been offered to her? That is the way the law worked in France, and that's what she had a right to do. In addition, in Burlington Northern versus Santa Fe, Catherine Gojek had a right to stay once she was offered the position by Cruzet, once there was an agreement that she would stay in Washington. The point of the justification hearing is because under EDF's own policies and under French law, Catherine Gojek had a right to stay once she had been given that mission. There was a full hearing as to whether or not she was justified in staying. Now, at that point, EDF had already engaged in the retaliation. They'd already decided that her complaints were blackmail, so it's no surprise then that they found that she wasn't justified in staying.
The problem is the premise of your statement's wrong. There was no agreement, as I remember the record. There's nothing in the record to indicate that there was an agreement that she could stay.
There was. Cruzet had already agreed with her that she could stay through their conversations.
There's nothing in the record that indicates that there was an agreement, that is, a back and forth. There is a self-serving statement, but my understanding is those agreements are formalized. There was no agreement reached.
Well, there's
He sent it on to another official.
Right. There's no agreement. I mean, you've been riding that premise continuously, and the premise is wrong. I mean, I just checked. There was no agreement. He said, all right, I'll pass it on.
He agreed with her, and then there was an email.
But there was not. That's not an agreement. He said, I agree to pass it on.
He said it looks in line with the discussions that we had.
It looks in line. That's not an agreement. You know that. You're a good attorney. A looks in line is not an agreement.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, before I conclude, if there are no other questions on the Burlington Northern versus Santa Fe, again, what is an adverse employment action is anything that would dissuade a reasonable employee from complaining and being threatened. And although I appreciate Your Honor's views that Catherine Gojek was not threatened. In fact, she testified at length in her deposition that this was a very telling period for her. And in numerous complaints that she made to EDF, she complained over and over that the treatment that she was receiving from Nadal and that the situation as it was occurring was very distressful to her. So I believe that Catherine Gojek has proffered sufficient evidence in her complaints that she was distressed and troubled by the entire incident and, in fact, felt threatened as a result of the comment made by Cruzet. Thank you.